You're listening to Community Radio, CKMS Radio Waterloo, 102.7, 946 on the Rogers Digital Network.
Good morning, Waterloo Region. It is Monday, the 7th of September, Labor Day. Into September already, fall is coming. We have Amanda DiBattista in the studio with us today from the Laurier Sustainable Food Project. We'll be speaking with her in just a few minutes. Right now we're listening to Side Street Dive. This is First Step.
Reach
that Side Street Dive here on CKMS Community Connections. My name is Bob Jonkman. In the studio today, we have Amanda DiBattista. Amanda, welcome to CKMS Community Connections.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you here. You're with the Laurier Sustainable Food Project?
The Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems, yes.
Sustainable Food
Systems.
Yeah,
we're a research center out of Laurier University.
Mm-hmm.
And I am lucky enough to be the project coordinator there, which means I do a whole bunch of administrative and project management kind of stuff. But I also am the co-producer for Handpicked, a podcast that looks at sustainable food systems research through the lens of our researchers at the center.
Right. And podcasts are very dear to our heart here at CKMS.
Of course, yeah.
Because I was looking for locally produced podcasts to have, you know, an amalgam show of all the Waterloo Region produced podcasts, you know, just one episode here, one episode there.
Right.
But yours caught my eye. It's limited. It's only six episodes.
Only six episodes right now, but we're in production for season two. So we're hoping for another four or six episodes in the fall.
So Handpicked podcast is to be heard on Fridays at 10 o'clock in the morning. And we've had the first episode already.
You did. You heard our episode on, it was an introductory episode,
mm-hmm.
so it featured the voice of the center's director, Dr. Allison Blay Palmer,
mm-hmm.
as well as the voices of students and researchers from across the center talking about what a sustainable food system is, because a lot of people don't really know what a sustainable food system might be.
No.
So it's a really great primer to the work that we do at the center, but also to thinking about food system sustainability more broadly.
Okay, so sustainable food systems. To me, that means you pick a carrot, you plant a carrot.
I mean, that's part of it, absolutely. Our food system, I mean, if you think about a food system, it's everything from the seed to the compost heap
mm-hmm.
or the dump, hopefully not
okay,
the dump,
yeah,
but
yeah.
the dump. So it's all the bits of the supply chain. So production, processing, distribution, retail, waste management, all of that. At the Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems, we look at how to make that system more sustainable. So better for people, the planet, and the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at all dimensions of sustainability. We really want to try to create food systems that are localized, that are ecologically regenerative, that are socially just, fair, economically viable, all of those really important things for sustainability. And what you'll hear in the first episode, if you heard it on Friday or if you're going to tune in this weekend later, is that sustainable food systems are really an aspirational thing. We're never going to get to perfect sustainable food systems. And our work at the center is working with local communities to build the food systems that they want. So looking at sustainability in different places and in different ways.
So the first thing that I would think that needs to be sustainable is environmental sustainability.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's a really big part. But I think for us, the key to thinking about sustainable food systems is that we can't separate the environment from people or the economy, right? In Canada, food insecurity is shockingly high. One in eight people, households in Canada are food insecure, and that means that they don't have access to healthy or affordable food, or they can't afford food. Food is, and that's a whole other issue about poverty. One in six children are food insecure. And food insecurity varies really widely across geographies. So here in Ontario, in the Waterloo region, 1 in 10 families are food insecure. In Ontario, about 13.3%, if we're going to get super, super detailed.
1 in 7?
Well, yep, 13% are food insecure. In Nunavut, over 50% of people are food insecure. So, and we also know that folks from Indigenous communities and Black communities are three times more likely to be food insecure. So that's a serious, serious problem. So when we're looking at making food systems more local and more organic and fair, those need to, when we're thinking about the environment, we also need to be thinking about social justice.
And so when someone is food insecure, it
mm-hmm.
means it's a poverty issue. They don't have enough money to buy food.
Yes.
They don't have enough money to buy good quality food.
Good quality food.
Right.
That's exactly right. If you're buying only ultra-processed foods, that comes
mm-hmm.
with, or if you're consuming only ultra-processed foods.
Kraft dinner and ramen noodles.
Yeah, right. And that's often what you can get at food banks.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, food banks have their place, absolutely. But we need to move people out of poverty so that we are feeding them well, feeding them with culturally appropriate food as well. Because food is not just about sustaining life. Food nourishes your body. It nourishes your mind. My mom always used to tell me, you have to eat a good breakfast in the morning because you can't learn if you're not well-fed. And, you know, we see programs in schools across the region and across the province that that take that up. But we need to be doing a better job to lift people out of poverty. And we think we can do that partly through food systems.
What you said about culturally appropriate food is very true. We've got the Multicultural Festival here in Kitchener. It didn't happen in real life this year. But the best part of that is going around to the mall area and going to all the different food tents, you know.
Absolutely.
Tasting the different foods from all the different cultures. Culture is expressed through food.
Absolutely, absolutely. And our researchers are working with folks across the country and in international areas as well. So what we're finding is that people at the local level really have the solutions in their pocket, right? Like, we've got a researcher in the Northwest Territories, Dr. Andrew Spring, who works with the Kagitu First Nation in Kakisa. And they are finding incredible solutions that are not only culturally appropriate, but also help them to adapt to climate change, which, as everybody knows in the North, is proceeding at, like, incredible rates.
Yes.
Incredible rates.
So a 1 degree difference in temperature here doesn't mean that much difference. You know, what's the difference between 29 and 30? What's the difference between 21 and 22? But up north, what's the difference between 0 and 1? You know, it's freezing and thawing.
Well, and not only that, but it's warming at 3 times the rate that it is here. So if we go up 1.5 degrees, they are, oh my gosh, my math is bad. Sorry. Sorry.
4.5.
They're going up 4.5 degrees. And when you are on a landscape that is on permaculture or permafrost, and your permafrost starts to melt, that means there's land loss. There is, the environment is changing wildly. They're losing the animals and the animals that have normally sustained them. So they are having to really think about how to use food as a way to nourish themselves as communities and people, but also to mitigate climate change and adapt to climate change.
And so there, environmental stewardship is directly related to food security.
Absolutely. So in our third and fourth episodes, we talked to Dr. Spring and his colleagues, Malene Simba and Chief Lloyd Chico, and they really talk about stewardship of the land. And they talk about, they say things like, if we take care of the land will take care of us. And we know how to take care of the land. So it's incredible to listen to them talk about their work. And one of the things that is really particularly interesting for me about the work that is happening at the center and through Handpicked is that that information is being shared across communities in new ways. So it's sort of like it's kind of like spidering out in unexpected ways, which is just delightful.
So there's the cultural aspect of food, the environmental aspect of food. You mentioned a raft of other things.
I did, yes. We're really trying to talk about resilience at the center, especially in the wake of COVID-19. I think that the pandemic has really shed a light on some of the very serious cracks in our food system. And I think that it's also an opportunity to rethink the way that we do things. Here in the Waterloo region, I don't know about you, but my feeling when the pandemic hit was, oh my goodness, I need to support our local farmers. How do I get back to the coffee shop that I love down the street? And some of the research that we're doing through the center is helping solve those problems as well. In particular, Dr. Teresa Schumelis is also the director of Open Food Network Canada, something that your listeners actually might be familiar with because it is a digital way to get food from local producers into local markets in new ways. And in the Waterloo region, it just took off because it was offering folks a real socially just and new way to participate in markets that isn't through the major grocery chains or isn't through brick and mortar stores, right? So it allowed folks to pivot and respond to the pandemic in really quickly, which is extremely important for local businesses.
And this is producer to consumer or producer to distributor to consumer?
That's the brilliant thing about Open Food Network. It's both. So it is a platform that is it's totally open source, and the coders, the whole platform is built around social justice and fairness. So it allows producers and processors the opportunity to really think through how they want to get their food to market. So whether it's direct to consumers, like Bailey's Local Food does, whether it's to distributors or through creating food hubs, because it's open source, you can put questions out or requests out to this collective of coders, and they'll solve your problem. If you have a little money to throw at it, that helps. Right. But they will solve the problems in queue. So I think that it opens up all sorts of different ways to really get local producers to market.
Right. It does depend on the end user having access to internet, and I think some of the food insecure folks may not have that.
100%. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. So you're the project manager of a research project.
Of a research center,
Research center. You're out in the field doing research on how to grow sustainably. You're out in the field looking at cultural aspects of food availability to other cultures in the area. How do you do research on food sustainability?
I am actually not in the field, which is unfortunate. I am responsible for all the communications and sort of making sure that all of the researchers are kind of going in the same direction. I heard the cats. Don't tell them I said that. but our researchers are absolutely in the field. So Let me talk about Teresa Schumelis as an example.
Okay.
So she was working directly with Bailey's Local Food, a food hub here in the Waterloo region, to really figure out how to use Open Food Network to meet their needs. So that means that she may have been in the office now and again, but she was mostly out working with the working with Bailey's, thinking through the how to use this technology in new ways, and building that project. So part of it is doing the work, the actual practical work, and then the other part is documenting that and bringing a critical theoretical lens to it. So, you know, Teresa really looks at food sovereignty and the link between food sovereignty, which means people's right to food and their right to culturally appropriate food and to determine their own food systems. So she's linking that idea with technological sovereignty, which is the right of people to control their data and to control data more generally, and the need to have open source data be part of what we think about as important as a society, right? We need to be able to control our data rather than big corporations.
Yes.
So she brings that theoretical lens to the practical work of setting up a food hub.
And how do you get the buy-in from the different producers, distributors, retailers? Where does that come from?
We work directly with communities. And our the way we do our work is we build trust-based relationships over the long term. So it's not like Teresa just went to Bailey's Local Foods and said, hey, here I am, work with me. She had a relationship with them, and she built on that relationship with them to better understand the research and the work that would meet their needs. So researchers at the Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems engage in what's called participatory action research or community-driven research. So we work with communities to do the research that they want that's going to help them reach their goals.
So as a research project, you're publishing papers, you're producing results, but it doesn't sound very scalable to have your researchers go out to every community in turn to implement these ideas.
Yep.
What better ways are there to achieve this?
Well, I think the brilliant thing of the center is that we're not just working in individual communities. We are doing work in individual communities, absolutely, but we also have researchers who are working on things like the national food policy. So I'm going to take two steps back for one second.
Yep.
Sorry, move from the mic too. The Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems is like an umbrella. And within that center, we have several different projects that we're working on. One of our keystone projects is called FLEDGE, Food Locally Embedded, Globally Engaged. And that is a research partnership with over 90 researchers, community partners, and policymakers that looks at sustainable food systems as a lever for change. So there are this large group of people across Canada in 7 different research nodes across the country, and in 3 international working groups that look at themes. So one is food policy, one is sustainable food system assessment, and the other is agroecology. So we're working in all these different places, making connections and building networks. Then we're working with international partners to address certain themes. Mm-hmm. And then we're sharing that information across the network. And that's one of the ways that that these things that are happening at the very local level become scalable, because folks are learning about them in different places, and we've created these networks that then can talk to each other and find solutions across places. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the work that's happening in the Northwest Territories, I was telling you about mm-hmm. a few minutes ago, we brought Chief Lloyd Chico down to Brazil to one of our international partners' spaces. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of farmers working on yerba mate, a tea production.
Oh, yeah.
And they're doing it in really interesting ways using agroforestry. And that is a method of production that relies on agroecological growing methods, which are growing methods that are good for the land, mm-hmm. Really prioritize food sovereignty, so farmers' rights, and the rights of the land and ecologically regenerative processes. And in the context that the yerba mate growers are working, it's in the forest. So it's ecological growing in forests. And we've seen a really interesting connection between the work that's happening there and the work that's happening in the Northwest Territories. So we were able to bring Chief Lloyd Chico to Brazil to have a conversation and to really learn from each other. And now that that connection is turning into another project that's also going to hopefully involve folks in Kenya. So we're building connections to scale things up. Okay. But we also do some international work and policy right. work at the national level. So it's a really diverse group of researchers.
Right. And so the policy work includes government legislation to mm-hmm. enact the policies that you're proposing through your research.
Yes, yeah. exactly. We're trying to make sure that we are giving decision makers the information that they need to make good decisions about food policy.
Okay. And you said internationally, some exciting things that I saw on your website.
Yes.
We'll get to that in a bit. Mm-hmm. I'd like to take a quick break. A gentleman named Jeremy Genoux, who sent us a CD, I think, all instrumental stuff. Here's something he calls Climate Rag, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Embrace Change. Thank you. Jeremy Genoux on violin, I think, with a whole bunch of other people on various other instruments, and somebody apparently on the mouth trumpet as well. That's called Climate Rag, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Embrace Change. We'll have Jeremy Genoux on an interview at some point in the future, probably in October sometime. In the meantime, we have Amanda DiBattista from the, Laurier Sustainable Food. No.
Very close.
Okay.
It's the Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems. We call it LCSFS, so good luck with that.
I don't think
that's worse.
No, that doesn't help. So we're talking about some of the international work that LCSFS.
does.
And I happened to go through the webpage, and I saw something about UNESCO.
Yes. We are super jazzed. We, Dr. Allison Play Palmer just received the UNESCO Chair on Food, Biodiversity, and Sustainability Studies earlier this year. We launched the chair in February, and it's part of this large international network of UNESCO chairs. And the UNESCO Chair program is really focused on the on international inter-university cooperation, with a focus on the key priority areas of the agency itself. So UNESCO really looks at education, natural and social sciences, culture, and communication. So we're really excited about this chair because it helps us to build on the existing networks through the LCSFS, but it also lets us participate in international conversations in a bit of a different way. And it lets us prioritize public education. So we've always been really focused on sharing knowledge. That's a really big part of what we do, especially around communicating research outputs and research back to our communities. But this is going to give us an opportunity to put that research on a larger stage.
Okay. And you mentioned you have researchers, well, in Brazil.
In Brazil, yeah.
And I imagine in other localities as well.
Yeah, we have a lot of the work that we do on agroecology is taking place in the Global South. So there's researchers in Brazil. There are community partners in Mexico and Cuba that work mm-hmm. with Dr. Aaron Nelson at the University of Guelph. And we have partners through RUAF, which is an international agricultural organization that Lane Young, our co-producer of mm-hmm. Handpicked, is working with as well in Quito, Ecuador. We also are making new connections with folks in Kenya, and okay. we already work with folks in Milan and Montpellier in France, and the FAO. So we have all sorts of networks that we're going to be drawing on and making more robust. Oh gosh, we have folks in Australia and South Africa and the States as well.
By necessity, I think you would be doing research in rural areas.
Yes.
But urban areas are encroaching on rural areas all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a part of the focus of research?
Yeah, we actually work in, I would actually say that we probably work in 50-50 in rural and urban areas. Some of the research that Dr. Allison Blay Palmer is doing is really interesting in that regard. And there, she's working on a project called the City Region Food Systems Toolkit. And a city region food system is looking, it sort of takes up what you're talking about, mm-hmm. right? This movement of folks in rural areas to urban areas, and looks at how that's changing landscapes and urban areas and in rural mm-hmm. areas, but also thinks about a city as a part of a region. So if you've got a city, say, like Toronto, Toronto's not growing all of its own food, right?
It couldn't.
No, absolutely not. So that food system in Toronto necessarily includes also all the rural areas around. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, obviously our food system is highly distributed, so it's also relies on international markets and all that. Yeah. But there's an opportunity to really think about city region food systems as a more localized way of growing, producing, and eating food. So the City Region Food Systems Toolkit looks at ways to make city region food systems more robust and more sustainable, and offers really concrete tools back to practitioners and policymakers who want to do that. So the first page of the first phase of the project really looked at building multi-stakeholder processes and tools around that. And the second stage of the process that they're in right now is really taking the opportunity to look at pandemics and COVID-19 response as an important part of this whole big puzzle.
Right. Waterloo Region seems like an ideal research territory because mm-hmm. you've got the urban core and the rural horseshoe surrounding it. Lots of research taking place here in the region itself?
Yes, there is a little. We're really excited to use the UNESCO chair to build more robust networks in the Waterloo region. Mm. Because our research networks have been pretty big, and the hub at the Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems, we've sort of done less research and more network building ourselves in the place where we are. So we're really excited to do more research here and build better connections with the region. We have worked with the Waterloo Region Food Systems Roundtable. Mm-hmm. And again, I was telling you before about Bailey's Local Food Market and Open Food Network, Open Food Network Canada, which is based here in Waterloo. But we are really hoping to expand those networks.
I was concerned when I asked the question initially more mm-hmm. about not so much rural people moving mm-hmm. into the urban areas and, you know, depleting our rural areas of agricultural knowledge and workers and farmers, but about urban sprawl mm-hmm. encroaching on and removing rural farmland.
Mm-hmm. That is a big concern, for sure. It's a big concern.
Yeah. Is that a global phenomenon or...
Oh, that's a really good question.
Strictly here in the Western world.
That's a great question. I'm not sure that I'm the person to answer that well, but I think it is a concern everywhere. I think for us, a really big concern is that farmers in rural areas and peri-urban areas, that space between the rural and the urban, often are among the most food insecure folks around. They are working really, really hard to make a living, but not able to always afford the food that they're growing.
Right. I think I'm going to take a quick break and listen to a bit of music, and then we'll have an opportunity to carry on in a few minutes.
Don't run away, girl, we can stay. Slow it down, put your head on my shoulder. When it gets cold, you can come over, yeah. Show up, just the thought, hold me now and leave it, yeah. This night's just a feeling, so we'll be and you can leave it. Oh, all the time that you care.
worry for nothing. Don't fall apart with all you thought you needed. Don't let the day run, you got more to believe in. From hurt to a reason, I hope you grow that pain to a dream. Yeah, I hope you look back and smile. I hope you laugh with the past and the past when it's been a while. You don't have to complicate it. You don't have to fight, cause I will, yeah. But you know we got all we need. I'll build a house in this darkness to see a little light. Yeah, you can come stay with me. Cause when the night gets cold again, you can come over, we'll pretend. We're far away, far away from it all. Put the weight down and faith that it's long gone. When time cuts through your days, don't run away, girl. Your head on my shoulder. Now when it gets cold, you can come over. Yeah. I just wanna be you. When it gets cold,
that's Busty and the Bass. Busty and the Bass is a Canadian electro-soul and hip-hop band from Montreal, Quebec. The band is known for its unique brand of music, which incorporates two vocalists, a horn section, and a diverse range of musical genres. They sent us a CD, which we've put into our digital music library, and we get to listen to that every once in a while. In the studio, we have Amanda DiBattista from the Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems.
You got it.
All right. Welcome to CKMS Community Connections.
Thanks for having me, Bob. Yeah.
We were talking about international work that the center does. And we were talking about the UNESCO chair.
Yep.
And we were talking about some local activities that that are happening in Waterloo region.
Mm-hmm.
Globally, we've got this climate crisis happening.
We do, yes. Yeah.
And you mentioned that food production, food distribution is one of the huge components of greenhouse gas emissions.
It sure is. We know that that food significantly contributes to climate change. And we know that all parts of the food system do this. At the Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems, we really see food then as part of the solution to some of these humongous problems. Mm-hmm. So if we can make our food systems more sustainable, then we have a really good shot at tackling the climate crisis in a way that is good for people as well, right? We're not just prioritizing the environment. I think that it's extremely important to deal with this issue in a real way. I think that we really see the food system as a solution rather than
right.
it's part of the problem, but that means that it's a lever right. for change. So through the UNESCO chair, we've been really thinking about this, especially in relation to COVID-19. COVID-19 has been devastating, absolutely.
Yes.
But like the climate crisis, it offers us like a window into some interesting
yes.
solutions. So in the work that Alison Blay Palmer is doing with the UNESCO chair on food, biodiversity, and sustainability studies, we've been really working with CC-UNESCO, which is the Canadian Commission of UNESCO, the sort of governing body for the UNESCO chair program in Canada, and several universities and other chairs across Canada to really try to imagine how we recover from COVID-19 with the environment in mind and with food mm-hmm. systems in mind. So we have created the Building Back Better Task Force, and we have a series of publications through iPolitics that really focus on green infrastructure, food systems, and ecosystems and biodiversity as places where we can spend our infrastructure money, recovery money, that will make an amazing impact. And not only an amazing impact to help drive the economy, but also a huge impact on the lives of people and making
right.
our people's lives better. Yeah.
So addressing some of that food insecurity you were talking about
Absolutely.
At the very beginning yeah. as a nice side effect of dealing with COVID-19 and you know, food production, food distribution.
Yeah, and we really need to make sure that we prioritize equity and social justice in that. We know that folks in marginalized communities have been the most impacted by COVID-19 in Canada and around the world. So we need to make sure that that spending is done with equity in mind mm-hmm. and with the environment in mind. We have an opportunity here to address climate change pretty meaningful ways.
Yeah, it looks like you're going to hit a triple homer here.
Here's hoping, right?
Yeah, climate change, food insecurity, yeah. And just poverty in general, perhaps.
Yeah.
You mentioned money, and mm-hmm. I'm curious, how does the center get funding?
That's a great question. We are part of Laurier University, so the center has its operating budget, a very small operating budget, mm-hmm. through the university. But we also do a lot of grant writing. So, for instance, the FLEDGE project is a SHRC-funded project, the Social Sciences and Humanities Council of Canada, I think. Don't tell them I've forgotten their name.
They're not listening.
Yeah, probably not. So they that is a SHRC-funded project. We have another project called Urbal, which focuses on urban-driven food system innovation and mapping that innovation, and that's an international project that's funded by the German government and some of our international partners. Our city region food system work is with the FAO, so it gets a little bit of money from there and the German government as well. Sorry, that's the one that's German government, and the other is... the Italian government, I think. So the work we do is really it's funded by a bunch of different places, research funding bodies for the most part.
And industry funding? Are you getting support not from industry?
No.
And any speculation as to why that might be the case?
Well, because we're a university research center, we want to make sure that we prioritize the research.
So it's your quest for independence from the corporate shackles, rather than the industry not wanting to fund something that might change their way of operations?
Oh, that's a good question. And I think I don't know that I can answer that particularly well. It isn't something that we have explored thus far.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. If anything else, you said you had a list of things.
I
if
do.
Not, I have lots more music.
I would love to tell you a little bit about Handpicked.
Of course, the podcast. That's why you're here in the first place.
I know. Come on, Bob. I have an entire page of notes on Handpicked. Yeah. So Handpicked is the Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems podcast. Mm-hmm. And we started last year. We have 6 episodes in our first season. And Lane Young and I produce and host the podcast. All of the episodes are free and available on any platform. All you have to do is search us, search for Handpicked Stories from the Field. And folks can follow us on Twitter at Handpicked Pod C or find us on Facebook at Handpicked Podcast. What I'm excited about with this podcast is that we are able to tell the story of the researchers at the center. And I think as somebody who is a researcher and has been in the university for pretty much as long as I can remember. I think that one of the things that we don't always do a great job of as university researchers is getting our research out into the public. So sustainable food systems aren't necessarily on the tip of everybody's tongue. With Handpicked, though, we can get the stories and the incredible work that folks are doing into your ears. And there's something really magical that happens when you get to hear about research from a researcher. So, for instance, we talked to Dr. Andrew Spring and his partners in the Northwest mm-hmm. Territories, and we heard the voices of the folks in the Northwest Territories telling us about climate change adaptation, telling us exactly how the land had changed and about how climate change was making their normal harvesting and food ways, harvesting routes and food ways unpassable. And folks were falling through the ice. And like, there's something about bringing research to life in that way that's incredible. So there are our episodes in the first season really span an interesting range of food systems research, including work in the Northwest Territories and the work that I was telling you about here in Waterloo Region with Teresa on Open Food Network. We also have an interesting episode on international agreements like the Sustainable Development Goals and the Milan Urban Food Policy Pact, and how those agreements play out in the local context. So you can imagine things that are negotiated, these agreements that are negotiated at really high levels, don't always translate to work on the ground. They're hard to figure out what to do with. But we give a really interesting example of Toronto's use of the Milan Urban Food Policy Pact to inform their policy and inform the way that they think about food systems as a good example of a city that's really taking those international agreements and putting them into practice in interesting ways. And we have an episode with Dr. Nevin Cohen from New York about food system metrics, which sounds like it's, it's okay. Really interesting.
I'm a math nerd.
Oh, perfect. So it sounded, when we proposed this one, I was like, oh my goodness, what are we going to talk about? Metrics, come on. But it turns out to be fascinating because he tells us that what gets measured gets managed. So if you don't have the data, you can't make good decisions. So him and his team are using things like Google Maps to track how cities are gentrifying or places are gentrifying or changing, and how that impacts, and look at how that impacts food systems. So he's connecting, he calls them hidden food metrics. So things that you don't normally associate with measuring the food system, like whatever, food bank use or food insecurity, right? Mm-hmm. He's looking at the disappearance of local markets and corner stores and those sorts of things to really think through the way that food systems are changing as well. So that's a fascinating episode. That's episode number two.
Right. Mm-hmm. What have you got planned for the next season?
Oh, I'm so excited that you asked me. We have already recorded our first episode, and that is on Lane Young's research in Quito. In Ecuador. So she is working with Agripar in Quito, and they are an urban agricultural association or program that is really taking food sovereignty to heart in their programming. And they work with quite a few women and youth in the area. So Lane looks at that work through an intersectional feminist lens. So she's looking at how race and gender and ability and all of the things that make up people's identity and class really impact their ability to participate in urban food projects and urban agriculture projects. And we are also now working on a episode on digital technologies in agriculture with Dr. Irina Knezovich out of Carleton. And we're going to be looking at how Amazon's entry into food retail space is troubling, and how digital technologies have their place for sure, but also we need to be very critical and thoughtful about the way we are bringing technology into that space.
Interesting that you'd say that after having just lauded the benefits of the Open Food Network.
Right. So the Open Food Network I'm really excited about the juxtaposition of these two episodes, because Amazon is a for-profit, entirely proprietary thing, whereas Open Food Network, the whole business model is based around social justice, equity, and open source, non-proprietary software. So these are activist coders, and it's fascinating to see the difference in the way that that sort of ethic plays out on the ground for producers and processors and retailers. That episode, if you can listen to that episode, I guess it's going to be in 5 weeks. It's episode 6, We Are All Shepherds of the Data. One of my favorite moments in the entire first season comes in that episode, where Teresa tells me that this is how she wants to spend her retirement years, working with activist coders. She has been a farmer and a food sovereignty advocate and researcher for years and years and years. She's always been an activist. But as she has encountered this space in retirement, she has just come to life And it's the kind of moment that a podcaster dreams of, right? Yeah. Like, it's podcast gold. It gives me goosebumps every time I listen to it.
You're in a good area for that, too. Waterloo Region is just full of people who are into the free software movement. There's the Kitchen Waterloo Linux User Group, of which I'm a very proud member. Used to have the Software Freedom Day, which is actually coming up on Saturday, the 19th of September, is International Software Freedom Day. So, and we used to have things there. We had KW Linux Fest, the Toronto Linux Fest a few years ago. It was actually entirely staffed by people from Waterloo Region. So lots of coder activists here. The Civic Hub has access to, or Civic Tech, rather, has access to people that are doing coding for government issues, so municipal elections. The most comprehensive website was put together by the Civic Tech group. So you've got resources here if you want to make use of them.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think that Teresa has been, I can't remember the name of the group that she's in, but she's in a group with that addressed activist coders. And I didn't know there was such a thing until we interviewed her. It's pretty incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Best code comes from people who open their code to others to review, and that just improves things all over.
Well, and that's what Open Food Network is built on. All of the code that goes into Open Food Network has to be open source, and that means, and the way that Teresa just describes it is, we are always standing on each other's shoulders.
Yes.
And that means that, again, Open Food Network was able to pivot in a way that other platforms were not for COVID-19. In most of the local producers that I purchased through are now using Open Food Network, which was exciting for me to see as, a big fan of Open Food Network, but also a big fan of local food. I saw them coming together in real time. It was very cool.
Right. So there's the digital aspect. There's the local aspect. Municipally, we have this group called Hold the Line, which is a group that celebrates municipal legislation. A few years ago, Waterloo Region said, we're stopping development in our rural lands. We want to put a hard line between urban development and rural agriculture, the countryside line. And the developer said, well, you can't do that. We're going to sue you. We're going to take you to the OMB and one of the Ontario Municipal Board. And one of the very few times that the Ontario Municipal Board sided with the municipality rather than the developers was in this particular case, which affirmed Waterloo Region's right to establish this countryside line to restrict development into our rural areas. And so if you travel along, say, Wilmot Line on the west end of Waterloo Region, you'll see built-up new housing developments on the one side and flowing rural agricultural land on the other side, a very hard line. Mm. And so Hold the Line is actually a celebratory festival that takes place usually around September or so. To celebrate municipal legislation. Where else do you see that happening?
So, that's a great question.
Yeah, so there's a bike tour that travels down the countryside line. There's overnight camping, music concerts, and everything. And I've never heard of anything like this before. But in the project's international travels, do you see other municipalities taking the lead on protecting agricultural lands?
I'm not sure that I can answer that question particularly well, because I am not always in the field, sadly. I am in the office, so I can tell you a little bit about what other folks are doing. I think that there are some really interesting ways that municipalities are imagining their role in food systems differently. We have a partner in Hastings County that is doing some really interesting work around, it's a little rural area outside of Ottawa, that's doing some interesting work on thinking it through policy around food. You've got the City of Toronto, who's really prioritized food as part of the way that they think about program building.
And we don't usually hear that, I didn't know that until you said so.
Well, I think it's an easy thing to know. If you're not sort of a staff there, if you're not the people pushing for it, it's easy to sort of miss. But I think that municipalities around the world, especially as things like the Milan Urban Food Policy Pact get more signatory cities, I think that cities are really starting to see their role in food advocacy and the benefit for them in terms of keeping their citizens healthy and addressing food insecurity and addressing climate change.
You know what? Hour's almost up.
Oh, my goodness. Really? Yeah. That's amazing.
Getting very, very close. Anything that you need to cover before we sign off for the day?
You know, Bob, I think that you asked me all of the questions that I have an answer for.
Excellent.
So I guess, you know, the one thing that I'd really like to talk about just very briefly is podcasting as a research tool. And I think that this is a very interesting and exciting time for podcasters that are in academic spaces. As we were talking about a little bit before, you know, open source code is really important, mm-hmm. and open access to research is really very important as well. So Lane and I, one of the reasons that we really wanted to make this podcast in the first place is because getting information out into the public is not always the easiest.
Right.
Often academic publications are behind a paywall, or they're so jargony, they're impossible to read. Podcasts give us an opportunity to really do something different and to bring research to life. And I think that that is starting to happen across universities in general. So that's
one of the mandates
exciting
for community radio as well, to bring
all
these things, you know, out to the public. So good synergy between us and you.
Thanks.
Amanda DiBattista, thank you very, very much for coming in today from the Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems.
You got it.
All right.
Thank you, Bob, for inviting me. It's been a delight.
It's been great having you here. Come back sometime.
Okay.
More Jeremy Janoux, who's taking us out. This is Time, Time, Double Time, Time. We'll have Jeremy on the show in a few days, in a few weeks. This is CKMS Community Connections. My name is Bob Jonkman. CKMS Community Connections is sponsored by Radio Waterloo. The executive producer is Jennifer Strong. Associate producers are Jordan Dorans, Jeff Stager, and Dylan Bravener. You can hear the second edition of CKMS Community Connections on Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. My name is Bob Jonkman. See you next week.